Hi, and welcome to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton, bringing you a special presentation from the 2019 IFPDA Fine Art Print Fair in New York City. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. I'm very excited to share with you today a conversation with the artist Swoon. Swoon is an artist who does large-scale street art using wheat-pasted relief prints. I know that I've stumbled upon a number of her street installations, and they always blend so beautifully with the existing spray paint graffiti and the detritus of city streets. She's been showing with Jeffrey Deitch, the powerful New York curator, since the beginning of her career, when she was still a student even, and her career has been multidimensional, including a number of projects that venture beyond static object making. One project of note is when she collaborated to create shelters for Haitian refugees after a devastating earthquake in 2011, which killed upwards of 100,000 people on the island. She also built a flotilla of rafts with friends, and they sailed down the Hudson River, putting on performances along the way. Shortly after, they took the same project to the canals of Venice, Italy, during the Venice Biennale. Honestly, there are too many cool projects here to mention, but I recommend you all check her out online at swoonstudio.org. Mainly today, the discussion revolves around printmaking techniques and an installation that Swoon was commissioned for that greeted you at the entrance to the print fair. She adorned a huge wall with a cornucopia of print work, including Xerox wallpaper, framed prints, mixed media collage, paper cuts, and lots of tiny details like boxes that create intimate moments. It was a captivating installation, reflecting everything that Swoon does. It was the first time the fair featured a project wall like this, and I look forward to seeing who they feature next year. Aside from the talk, I wanted to say thanks to anyone who donated to Let's Take a Press to Puerto Rico. I've got an update from the man himself coming soon, Joseph Velasquez of Drive-By Press, who hosted that fundraiser, and we'll learn more about what's going to happen with the press and other aspects of the project. Congrats also to Shelley at Printmakers Open Forum and the Lithosphere Project, where she raised $16,232 to rehabilitate her old press that she got, her Akuma. I just wanted to say thanks, and that all of this warms my heart, and that there's so much success and generosity going around. You know, today it's like I can't read headlines without banging my head against the wall, and seeing the beauty of art and community and collaboration has truly lifted my spirits. With that, we can get on to the talk. It's short and sweet, but anything with this artist is going to be inspiring, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
You're listening to The Printcast, Season 2, and you thought we wouldn't make it this far.
For this piece, you know, I knew you'd see it from afar, and I wanted to kind of have these big elements that would draw you in from afar, but then the tiny boxes are so that you can continue to get drawn in as you get closer, so you continue to have that experience of something that unfolds as you examine it.
I love the creativity that happens with limitations. When you have a limited range of iconography, how do you express your own creative vision? It's really fascinating, and that's something that you can see in printmaking practices.
Today on The Printcast, we bring you a special presentation from the 2019 IFPDA Fine Art Print Fair in New York, which took place in October of last year. The IFPDA is an organization of expert art dealers who champion the work of artists in the artistic medium of printmaking. Their annual print fair is the largest international art fair devoted to 500 years of fine prints. Today on the podcast, we join a discussion called Living History in Contemporary Printmaking, The New Renaissance of Etching. It's a conversation with artist Swoon, Nadine Orenstein, the Drew Hines Curator in Charge, Department of Drawings and Prints at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and Jenny Gibbs, Executive Director of the IFPDA, moderated by Sarah Douglas, Editor-in-Chief of Art News. Swoon, aka Caledonia Curry, is a Brooklyn-based artist who came to fame in 1999 while attending Pratt in New York City. She was pasting relief prints on the walls of Lower Manhattan, something that contrasted at the time since most street art was spray paint. Her earnest and soulful work caught the attention of gallerists and her career took off. Along with her mixed media art making, she has been involved in a number of community and philanthropic projects that prove she is always challenging herself and thinking beyond the white cube. The Printcast recorded this episode on Sunday, October 27th, in partnership with the IFPDA. Big thanks to everyone at the IFPDA, Art News, and to Nadine Orenstein, Jenny Gibbs, and Sarah Douglas for agreeing to share the audio today. Join me now in this discussion live at the Javits Center in New York City.
So I really would like to hear, because I think it goes straight to the point of what we're talking about here, when we talk about the project that Callie did, this project actually came about with the three of you talking about it. And I'll let you address this. As David said, you have him on one side of it. And then on the other side, you have, I have to admit, I have forgotten who the exhibitor
Brooke
was.
Brooke Alexander.
Brooke Alexander. Yeah. And you have some Saul LeWitt, and you have really modern, you know, 20th century prints there. So, and I think that's what you were trying to do with this project. Can you tell me a little bit about how it came about?
Sure. So the idea actually originated in a conversation with Nadine, and sort of just jumping back. So I've been with the IFPDA since February, and when I first met with Mr. Tunick and other members of the search committee, there was a concern expressed that people aren't making prints anymore, that collectors are aging out, that the dealers are aging out. And I said something to the effect of, "Are you kidding me? All the cool kids are making prints." So I had an idea in the back of my head that I wanted to find a way to bring this community, the printmaking community, particularly the Brooklyn printmaking community, into the fair. And then David was kind enough to introduce me to Nadine. He said, "You must meet my former student, Nadine." And we had a conversation. She told me about the Renaissance of Etching exhibition that was opening, and we thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to come up with a project that really sort of connects the dots between contemporary printmaking practice and the Renaissance of Etching? And the first artist who came to mind was Callie.
Okay, so Callie, so they come to you, and, you know, just to skip to the finished product for a moment, you know, you see actually this sort of where the etching comes in, which you've referred to as a kind of old world part of the piece, is actually where you've got this modern dealer on that side, and it kind of progresses to, you know, newer techniques. Can you tell me sort of your thinking? You know, they got in touch, they said, "Hey, there's this project, it's going to be at this fair." What were your thoughts about that?
The thing that I love about this fair in particular is the way that it does this kind of trajectory from, you've got like Durer and Rembrandt, you know, right next to Saul LeWitt and people who are creating today. And as somebody who really loves the whole history of art making, and it's such a special kind of occasion, and so I was, you know, honored to be invited into such a space. And I definitely felt there was a little challenge posed because, like I said, the sort of etching work was really made outside of my installation context, because I found that the etching, I don't know, somehow it never quite played well with my installations. And so this piece was like, okay, let's make this kind of large installation piece, but let's include etching. And so there's this kind of core tension in the piece about how to kind of start with work that's in a square and work that feels like really rooted historically to this other side of the piece that actually is quite ancient techniques as well, but that are done in a particularly, you know, in a way that was designed to be seen out on the street in this kind of loud environment, designed to sort of withstand rain and destruction and otherwise. And so it's a very different visual language, right. But I wanted them both to show up because you have that entrance into the fair. And so it's like you want to see something from afar and sort of feel that you're being drawn in.
One of the reasons why we particularly wanted to work with the Swoon project is her ability to transcend the frame, to be able to create this immersive, interactive environment. And, you know, in early conversations about the project with some of our committee and board members, there was a puzzlement. How can we create this an installation with prints? And I said, just wait and see, right? So I think that she's done that really successfully.
So to speak in particular about the etching aspect of it, can you speak generally about what role etching in particular plays, you know, in your overall practice?
So etching has been kind of just like a touchstone. The pieces that are on the wall represent, you know, every couple of years I've made one. The block printing and the paper cutting I just do in my studio on the floor. So I have ready access to that every day. But I don't actually, you know, for me, etching is still sort of a body of knowledge that is, you know, I look to the masters for that. I work with Tandem, for example, to create the two pieces. So etching for me is sort of, it's something that I'm kind of still learning, but the thing that I love about it is that as a drawer of portraits, there's just like a sensitivity and a delicacy to it as a medium that's really unmatched in like paper cutting or in block printing. And so it's something that I've always been drawn to and I just get drawn back to.
So I want to, Nadine, I want to go to you and first to have sort of your response to seeing the way that Callie's using etching. And then I wondered if you can talk a little bit about, I mean, I know you're mostly focused on the historical aspect, but, you know, when you're looking at artists who are using this technique today, what is interesting to you in that?
Well, I think it's interesting what Callie just said, because it actually reflects a lot of what was going on in the early 16th century when all of these artists were, and basically it started out basically printmakers who started using etching first, and they're all confronted with this new technique, and it's like, what do you do with it? Do you make it look like a drawing? Do you make it look like an engraving? Do you make it look like a painting? And then also, some of them did, you know, 6 prints, not for me, I'm going to move on. Other people are like, wow, this is the greatest thing, and it's really, you know, different people respond to these techniques differently. And I was talking to a printmaker, print publisher here at the fair the other day, who also said, yeah, I can see in some of these prints, they don't like doing it. And then other people, they love doing, you know, and I can see it's just like the people I work with today. You have that same reaction. And, you know, and Albrecht Dürer, I would have said to him, you know, try a different technique. and you know, really, he only made 6 prints, etchings, and he made a lot of engravings. And clearly, you know, it wasn't like exactly his thing. And so I think every artist is slightly different and really responds to the techniques differently. And then, you know, I love etchings, contemporary etchings too. I mean, at home I have a lot of black and white prints on my walls. And I find it interesting to see how, you know, even in the 16th century, people are trying to push the medium. I mean, this is what printmakers do all the time. They have this, what I like about printmaking, it's like a limited, very limited medium in terms of, you know, now you can do lots of colors. In those days, really, it was black and white or red and white. And it's like, how can I make it do more? How can I make, like, more tone out of this? What can I do, you know, to really push the boundaries? And I think, you know, people are doing exactly the same thing today. I was looking at a Japanese print where he's using, like, power tools to make the etching, and, you know, you're combining etching with other things to kind of make it into a big installation. I mean, everybody's got this, and I think that's sort of the challenge of printmaking. You have this technique that's limited in certain ways, and then how do you work around that and make it do more?
I mean, to that point, Jenny, I'm curious, you know, you said there were these discussions when you first came in, and I think it's always the challenge is, you know, how do you make some of the traditional or historical things, I mean, not to, I feel like this is talked about too much, but how do you make that appeal to new audiences, right? And the idea of how in a fair like this, right, how does the historical stuff interact with some of the more cutting edge?
Well, I mean, you do have these wonderful adjacencies with the booths and 500 years of printmaking. And you have artists like Glenn Brown, who we can see from here, who's also making wonderful etchings after Rembrandt. So, of course, there's contemporary practice that's drawing on old master imagery as well. But, I, you know, one of the things that really drew me to the IFPDA is this wonderful living history, this idea that, as Nadine said, the techniques essentially, the core techniques remain unchanged. And I think I was originally an old master painting specialist at Christie's. One of the reasons why I love old masters is I love the creativity that happens with limitations. When you have a limited range of iconography, how do you express your own creative vision? It's really fascinating, and that's something that you can see in printmaking practices.
So I wanted to, Callie, ask you, you've obviously worked and exhibited your work in many different environments. I don't know if you've ever done a project for an art fair before, but I was curious as to, you know, you talked about some of the figures on the right side of the painting and how those might be something you might see in a public situation. I just wondered how, you know, seeing your work installed here and being around it, how you feel it lives in this environment, as opposed to other kind of museum, gallery, public, you know, yeah, on the street.
I guess the thing I appreciate about it in this environment is I feel like it's the sort of the thing that Jenny was saying about transcending the frame, that because this environment is so specifically about things that can be packed and unpacked, it's hard to get really expansive. And so I was kind of given that permission to be like, just get expansive, you know, just kind of like let these pieces, you know, be something that doesn't have to be an object that gets removed, and making work that doesn't always have to be an object that gets, you know, that shows up easily is like right, something that I've been working with for a long time.
And I also don't want to forget to, since are they still showing the piece here sometimes?
Yeah, it's in one of the rotations.
Because I wanted you to just, you know, I was asking you a little bit about if you've seen the piece. There are, you know, individuals who are depicted here. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about some of the imagery and, mm-hmm, and the people who are shown here.
Yeah. So this installation really, for me, it kind of represents like an x-ray of my work in general and also of printmaking practices. And so the, you know, there's a few techniques, and actually photocopy is included, because I feel like as we're really talking about reproduction, I kind of love photocopy as reproduction. So the wallpaper is created in that way, and then it's stained, and then you have paper cutting, and you have these individuals. And the doors, the little door set that you see, actually, I'm just going to call you out, Jeffrey Deitch is here in the audience, and I've done a lot of projects with him, including we built some rafts that came down the Hudson River and that actually went in the Adriatic Sea to Venice. And so, you know, with the question that I was asking of how do I take these kind of square language and sort of seamlessly like transition it into this like kind of a little bit more immersive language, I sort of just decided to bring in some of the objects like those boxes or those doors, where I'm kind of condensing a little bit of like the installation language into a small space. And then as far as the individuals themselves, there's a couple different of my own traditions that are sort of interweaving. And so one of them is just like observational street portraiture. So there's a couple, the second etching from the left is an observational street portrait. The etching of the woman who has chicken legs, that's actually the fairy tale witch Baba Yaga. Are you guys familiar with her? And so, but that was also just sort of started as an anonymous street portrait. And then there's this kind of other thread, which is drawing people who are very close to me, friends and family and people that I know very well. And so the leftmost etching is a portrait of my stepfather. The one in the middle is a friend of mine. We were on the rafts together. It was just like a portrait while we were hanging out. And then the two women on the right are both women artists that I know and love and work alongside. And the portrait on the left is my friend Sasu, and it was kind of right at the moment that she had her first baby, and she was thinking through how do I continue to be a living and working artist and be a mom. And so I was really moved by, you know, where she was at in her life and drew her portrait. And then the second is another artist named Monica Canilau, who I've worked with in dozens of capacities, who lives out in the Bay. So there's kind of quite a few narratives weaving through this piece.
But you were saying that this piece, you actually also see it as a kind of an ode to printmaking.
Definitely. Because there's so many, you know, for me it's like the kind of love song to printmaking, that there's so many styles. There's silkscreen and paper cutting and tiny installations and larger pieces. And I wanted it to be something that when you first see the thing of, are you guys familiar with Petra? This is a sort of a weird comparison. But do you know that city? So it's like, you go through this kind of crazy pass, and then you see this like temple that's carved in the rock, and then you continue to enter the city. And I've always loved those kind of entrances. And so for this piece, you know, I knew you'd see it from afar, and I wanted to kind of have these big elements that would draw you in from afar. But then the tiny boxes are so that you can continue to get drawn in as you get closer. So you continue to have that experience of something that unfolds as you examine it.
And I would add, I was remembering your show at the Brooklyn Museum, and so I was looking back at this piece that the Times wrote at the time, and you talk about, with your work, wanting to induce a sense of wonderment. Is that still something that you have in mind when you work?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, wonderment is one of those emotions that sort of you suspend your disbelief and you become quite open. And I love to try to create that moment. And then in that moment, what comes in? And for me, it's often about kind of empathy and looking and sort of seeing into the sort of tender parts of each other and ourselves.
I should say, when we went to your studio, it's like a wonderland. It's full of all of these pieces. And then she showed us the boxes and we're like, how on earth is she going to work that onto a wall? And it looked like, you know, things that you would have to open and pull things out. And I was thinking, you're going to have people standing there, guard, making sure they don't break. It's wonderful how you brought it all together.
And Jenny, I just wondered, you know, sort of two related questions. Obviously, you're new to this organization, and now you throw this at them. It's like, you know, I'm curious if there was anyone who was like, well, how are you going to pull that off, you know?
And I think there was that puzzlement as to how we create a site-specific installation working with prints, when I think we've answered that question now. Mm-hmm. But Nadine and I are already talking about what we might do next year, this idea of continuing to have the thread that weaves together the old master practice and contemporary practice. I wanted to say, one of the other things about Callie's practice, which gave me no fear at all about going forward with this, when we spoke at your studio, when you were talking about your street work, she speaks about it being civic-facing. And I love this idea that you've developed this practice sort of guerrilla style on the street, but with this sort of civic responsibility, knowing that it's going to be a work that that makes people feel good, this work of wonderment, which is really different from some other printmakers and artists that we can think of who are working on the street whose work is more transgressive, more aggressive, mm-hmm. and your work is always so optimistic. So there is no fear.
I feel like there's actually something there, maybe even an article, like non-aggressive street art, you know?
Mm-hmm. But Women.
Oh, and Kelly, you should tell that story about the guy on the street who felt like that was his work. It was such a sweet story. That you were telling us there was someone who kept pulling people over.
Yes.
Oh, this is
so there
work.
Was a. I made, speaking of wonderment, I made like these full installations which I photographed, and I was putting them into fences so you could kind of peer through and get this feeling like maybe you were looking into another world, although clearly you weren't. And there was a guy who lives in my neighborhood, and you know, he is just like this kind of really wonderful, little bit simple guy who like lives on the block, and he found it, and he just was like, this is my thing. And he would sort of flag strangers and be like, let me show you this, and like bring them over.
Yeah.
And that was, but I also had another moment here that was like, I was like almost in tears, like working, because I just feel like, you know, you as an artist, you want people to get what you're doing, right? You want, and so it was setting up and everyone's working and all this stuff is happening. And this guy comes by and he's got this huge cart of tools and he's just like pushing it. And then he stops and I just hear him and he goes, I feel like I could cry. I get it. And I turned around and I was like, what? And he points at the Baba Yaga and he said, she's it. She's the heart of it. She's the Mother Nature. And I was like, oh my God, like how were you able to just like hone in on that so deeply? Because, you know, the thing about the Baba Yaga is that she's this kind of fairy tale witch who will just as soon have your skull as help you. And she might do either. And I feel that there is something important about that archetype, and there's something important about kind of that relationship with nature of like loving and understanding both of those aspects. And yeah, I just felt like he saw it, and it was like this kind of amazing moment of like it can happen anywhere at any time in the middle of, you know, whatever's going on. And so yeah, it was like just started off perfectly.
Yeah, and it's such an amazing figure, because in a way you don't know if you should be scared of. I feel like we should have Natalie Frank come on the stage and talk about fairy tales. But you're not sure whether she's like this wise old woman you can trust or totally terrifying. So
yeah,
it's
both.
Somewhere in between. But speaking of reactions, I mean, Jenny, what are some of the reactions you've heard from both from people in the organization, exhibitors?
It's been nothing but positive. It's wonderful to just walk through and just see people just transfixed by it. It's also wonderful to see it from across the space. I was sitting in the seat with Jacob Javits across the way and just seeing it like Petra unfolding through the gates. It's been nothing but wonderful.
And you were saying also at night it has this, when it's spotlit, the rest is dark. And
now many people are asking me what we're going to do next year. So, yeah.
Well, it's a nice contrast because in the fair, you know, everything's framed and on the wall, individual pieces, and it's nice to have something that's, you know, kind of mixing it up and a counterpart to what goes on behind that wall.
Mm-hmm. And Kelly, I also want to ask you, sort of bringing us back to the historical aspects of etching in particular, you know, when you started working with etching, you know, were there artists from the past that you were especially inspired by the way that they use that technique?
When I started, I wasn't in particular looking at specific artists, but I had this moment this morning looking at the jurors that are in the show and just thinking how I grew up before I was a teenager before the internet. So I had, you know, kind of the books in the library. So the people whose lines I was really in love with were Van Gogh, Kati Kolowitz, and, you know, Toulouse-Lautrec. And then looking at the Durer, I think it's Christ, Man of Sorrows, or I just saw his lines and I was like, oh, I never really paid attention to how that kind of game of telephone was very much probably happening. And I could just feel the way that those lines and the way that the line work, the way that you have to make lines in order to create a print just became part of my drawing style. Yeah. You know, and feeling.
So by game of telephone, you mean you got Durer via other artists?
Yes,
that's
I
so
really
interesting.
Think so.
The way influence works.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I do want to make sure we have some time for questions as well, since we have a rather large audience, and there's probably some artists out there who want to ask very particular questions. I did promise I would pose a somewhat challenging question to the group, which is to really talk about printmaking in general today, and sort of what constitutes an original print today. Let's try. Who wants to give it a shot?
That's like one of those topics, you know, the Print Council of America ages, I don't know, years, decades ago, brought out a little publication, What's an Original Print? And it's still being argued about today. And it's there's so many things. I'm a traditionalist, but I'm sure other people have other ideas. It's changed. I don't know.
We had a wonderful conversation earlier this week with Jeff Koons, and one of the takeaways for that, for me, which I loved, was the idea that an original work of art is finished by the viewer, and that the viewer is the original ready-made. So we can be very metaphysical as well.
And I think for me as an artist, I almost think of it as the way it feels. And printmaking for me is about I'm at like repetition with differentiation. It's that ability to create tiny evolutionary steps by replicating something but changing it a little bit. And so I would define it personally as like how it sort of feels in my process to get that going of like as soon as you're starting to replicate something, like at that point I'm in printmaking mind.
I mean, one of the conversations, one of the themes that we've had throughout all of our programming and conversations is to bring the artist's intention into it. And so although we are very focused as well on the technique of original printmaking and the Printmaking Council's definition, we wanted to bring to foreground the role of the artist in that process as well, which I think is lost a little bit in that definition.
Well, I think what's interesting about your piece, Kelly, is that you're using a reproductive medium to make a unique piece, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that Koons answer is just like, I always think the guy should be a politician or something. I mean, he'd be like Marianne, what is her name? Like, because she's kind of wacky, and he could be like a wacky politician.
We've been calling him Art World Jesus.
Yeah. Okay. So I do want to, have some time. Do we have a microphone here that we are able to, good. So we have some microphones back there. Do we have any questions? Because if we don't, we will keep going for a little bit.
Would you actually trade a Durer for your piece?
Yeah.
Well, he's right next door, so that would be convenient.
You can talk later.
Now, I'm probably not supposed to say this, but I'll pose it as a question. Is there a possibility we might see this piece elsewhere than in this fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I made it, I really was just thinking of it for this fair, but I did have a conversation with somebody who loves printmaking and was like, this feels like it holds so many different languages. It almost feels like it could function even as an educational tool, as like a touring piece and kind of, you know, just like bring in to different places. And I'm open to that for sure. I think I would want to like adapt it a little bit with that touring aspect in mind, but I think it's possible. It also could come apart into its pieces and get reconfigured, which is a thing I also love doing, and I love that about printmaking.
I mean, speaking of education, Jenny, do you see the organization at large and even, you know, have a sort of role mm-hmm. with the fair to keep some of these techniques alive?
Sure. We're keeping the techniques alive and also keeping the conversation going. We've been, the response to the programming has been so positive that we hope to have year-round programming and ongoing conversations and more educational programs as well.
Great. We actually do have a question back here.
Okay, hi, thank you. I just have a request, I guess, for Jenny and Nadine. And considering that a year from now, I don't know exactly when the fair is going to be, but we have a pretty big election coming up, and I feel prints more than almost any other art form represent the democracy. They're really for everybody, and it's fine art for everybody. So I'd really recommend thinking about that when you choose the next big display of some kind. Thank you.
Sure.
I'd love to hear.
It's a democratic medium, and we've talked about including programming, printmaking as protest, right? That's a whole other theme that one could explore.
I mean, I feel like, Callie, that's been a part of your practice, that aspect of it.
The thing, so I did a talk years ago with Kiki Smith, and I remember her, she said,
She was here yesterday.
Oh, was she? Oh, amazing. I love her. And she said, the thing I most want us to talk about is the way that there's almost something inherently political about printmaking because anyone can do it and because you can reproduce it. And for me, you know, I was a kid living in Brooklyn, waitressing, and I wanted to make something that interacted with the city, but I needed to be something that I could do myself in my little studio, you know, on the floor. And there was something about, you know, carving a piece of wood or cutting a piece of paper that it really did give me this power. It was like a very big lever in very small hands, and it made this big impact that I couldn't have made unless I could physically do that reproduction myself. Because, you know, it wasn't like about getting something printed or how much that costs. It was about like how much sweat was I willing to put into it. That is what I was going to get out of it. And that's powerful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad Sue brought that up, because our exhibition next year at the Met is going to be a Goya drawings and prints show. And I think he's one of the real political artists. And I think it would also be very relevant for that moment. Yeah.
And I also I love that you use photocopying in here it as the background, because it comes down to, like, you know, when people had zines,
totally.
You know, it's like, that's printmaking. Like,
absolutely.
Anyhow, I saw another question back there.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I had a question about, like, I follow your Instagram, Swoon, and I see almost like every day you like do these really long like Q&A sort of answers that I think people maybe are like DMing you like questions or something. But I was curious, because it takes a lot of time and effort, and like you really give like very thoughtful responses. I was wondering like what spawned that practice or what keeps you doing that, because it's a lot of work and very generous of you.
Thanks for noticing that.
Yeah.
So I do it in the summer, and I recently started taking like sanity summers. I've never called them that before, but this was pretty good. Works. And I get into like a rural place, and I just am able to quietly dive very deep into doing my work. And so one of the things that I do is on one day, I just say, hey, who has questions for me? And everybody who posts a question that day, or almost everybody who posts a question that day, I then spend the rest of the summer just answering it. it. And I love it. It's so fun. You know, Instagram is one of those things I resisted social media for years. But once I got on it, I was like, oh, I am a chatty person. I am a communicator. I love to talk. And I love to write. And so it opened up this other aspect of my practice that I feel now that it's truly part of my art practice.
But that's really interesting because you've found a way to contain it, too, because it can also make you crazy. I mean, you're like, I need to do this right now. You know, if you have a technique for containing it, that's... Mm-hmm. Are there other... I saw a hand here.
Mussorgsky loved the painter, and I believe his name was Hartman. And there were 10 pictures at an exhibition, one of which was Baba Yaga. And... basically, the whole song, pictures at an exhibition, go from song to song to song to song. And I'm just wondering, was the Mussorgsky music there for you?
You know, I'm not actually aware of the Mussorgsky music, but I should become aware of it now.
I know the music. I didn't know that story. I'm going to check that out. That's fascinating.
Okay, so in the game of telephone, you weren't on that party line.
I wasn't. Not yet.
Anyone else? Baba Yaga lore?
Just a quick question. I'm fairly new to this, but one question I want to ask Swoon is, you know, there are many new ways to manipulate images and objects and structures. As an artist, how do you stay true to your art, but at the same time keep yourself relevant, you know, in this world where the number of ways to interact with the world is changing, like, you know, technology, et cetera. Thanks.
That's such a great age-old question. I can answer it personally. I don't know if anyone else has any other thoughts on it. But for me, I really feel that I have a relationship with something that is could very much be described as the muse in that classical sense, that there's a voice in me which is absolutely irrational, absolutely stubborn, absolutely the boss. And I just have to kind of go, you know, follow it as closely as I can. And that's how I ended up making rafts at a time where people are like, what on earth are you thinking? You know, right now I'm teaching myself stop motion animation. It's very much a process of just listening to that voice and then hoping that it makes sense after.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to hear Nadine on that from a historical perspective. I mean, I always think in art history, especially with regard to things like printmaking, like there are artists who are like early adapters. As you were saying, they're the ones who stick with it and innovate within it. There are others who sort of are like, no, I'm going to go back to... I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, I think... you know, artists have not changed that much today. You get the same kinds of range of people and approaches to techniques. I mean, obviously in those days there were guilds and there were certain subjects that sold, but there you see, you know, the experimenters, you see the people who are sort of the traditionalists, you see the people who are, you know, trying out, you know, being creative with a known medium. We did a show of a couple of years ago of the printmaker Hercules Segers, who was active in Holland in the 17th century, just before Rembrandt, who, like, was making printed paintings. And he was taking this technique of etching that had been done, you know, already for 100 years and just, like, rethought the whole thing and started, you know, created techniques that nobody had ever thought of. And he was working in a place, Holland in the 17th century, where like the most traditional printmakers were also active and, you know, making in. And I think in those days there was really more of this idea of like, this is how we make money from this thing. But I think really what I love about printmaking and you know, in our department at the Met, we really cover everything from the 15th century to present day, and you really see this continuity of kind of personalities, of ways of approaching a technique, ways of approaching a medium, and that's so satisfying. And, you know, and I love discovering that all the time.
And then you see such an expansion within the medium. Right.
Yeah.
This has been another theme throughout the programming. Yesterday, we had a wonderful conversation with Jim Dine, who told us about all the amazing things that you can do with very dangerous chemicals and power tools.
Yeah. So, are there any more questions out there? Well, we are going to wrap up. I'm sure if you have questions you were too scared to ask in public, you can come up and consult them individually. And thank you for coming to this talk.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. If you like what you are listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review on iTunes and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play, as well as online at theprintcast.com. Music for this special edition is by Broke for Free. Voiceover, editing, and production provided by your host, Nick Naughton. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you on another episode of The Printcast. Bye for now.